You and I have a peculiar history, Dirk, because we go back to something like 1992, except we didn't actually get to meet and work together until about 4 or 5 years ago.
No, we have this strange dancing around each other at long distance and lots of mutual friends, but we've never actually been in a room together.
So the first time that we should have actually talked directly, and probably the first time, I think I may well have got an email from you as far back as then in the early days of email, was 1992-ish when you wanted to do Sandman as a radio series.
And I was put on to you by Phyllis Hume at DC Comics, yep. Talked to Neil, he's a very nice guy. I got in touch, and that was a project we tried to get off the ground several times.
I loved the idea of doing Sandman for radio, and it made so much sense, and it was like you wouldn't have had to do very much to it, and DC Comics kept killing it because they were vaguely convinced somehow that if an English radio series of Sandman happened, it would somehow kill their movie prospects.
Yes, and like we killed Batman and Superman.
Exactly. Utterly. At the same time.
At the same time.
And Spider-Man, of course.
Yeah, murdered that one.
Yeah.
No films at all of Spider-Man in any recent years.
And then I got an email from Douglas Adams. And I got an email from Douglas, must have been about 98?
That would work, yeah.
And he was saying that he was going back to the BBC. They were going to do a radio adaptation of Life, the Universe and Everything, and if that worked, they were going to continue. And as far as he was concerned, there was only one person who could possibly do it, which was me.
Absolutely.
And I wrote back and said that was really nice and lovely, and it gave me happy, warm feelings, and if I had the time, I would have done it. But I was absolutely up to my eyeballs in everything at that point, and with enormous regret had to say no. And you did it.
I put my hand up for the job. And I'm very grateful to you for passing on it. But at the same time, I'm rather sorry we weren't working together on it, because it would have been quite a lot of fun.
Although we did eventually get to work together on Hitchhikers.
Yes, because you came and were voice of the book for our stage tour. And were excellent. And actually, one of the best voices we had. And I do remember your first time you came on stage in Edinburgh, you were quite nervous about it, and then you just gave this wonderfully controlled read. It's very good.
I wasn't nervous, I was terrified. I was absolutely
yes, there was you are the prince of cool, and it was okay. You carried it off really well,
and I know I loved it. And we had John Hodgman appeared as the dish of the day.
He did wonderful. Perplexed the audience slightly, and then they got it, and then they were wonderful. No, happy days. We've known a lot of really great people. We've been very lucky, and I think there's one thing. We share Douglas, in a way, as a mentor. Earlier for you, you knew him much earlier in the process, but when he asked if I was able, he asked the BBC if I was willing to go and finish Hitchhikers in radio, which, as a producer, I was more than happy to do. That really was a moment for me. It was a mentoring moment for me. And so in a way, he's been a sort of ghostly godfather to both of us.
Absolutely. I owe Douglas a debt that I could never repay. Douglas was one of the very first people I interviewed when I was a young journalist. And I interviewed him 2 or 3 times and sold the interviews in many, many places. And then was approached to write somebody else's book. Somebody else had started to write A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Companion and failed and couldn't do it.
And the book you wrote remains one of the funniest books written about Douglas, which isn't by Douglas.
I loved doing that style. I loved discovering that I could write like that. And it's not really doing Douglas is the fun. It's just doing classic British humour. Mm. You know, it's Alan Corran, it's all of these, P.G. Woodhouse. You sort of, all the stuff one read as a kid.
And in a way, that is very much Good Omens. They're weft through with that sort of humour. It's as if you've been, I get the sense from having adapted it, that it was as if you were slightly let off a leash at that time. because it's full of very, very funny stuff. And you are a funny, you can be a very funny writer, but it was as if you were allowed to play.
I was incredibly aware of, and I think I was incredibly aware because I'd been a journalist in the book world for the first, 8 years of my professional life at that point, was very aware how easily you get pigeonholed. And I was kind of scared of writing a funny book. And I'd written the Hitchhiker book, the Douglas book, and I'd been asked to write a book about Alan Moore after that, and started researching it, and then went, if I do a book about Alan Moore, I will now be that guy who writes books about other people. And I said no. And I think one of the reasons why I wrote the first chunk of Good Omens and then went, I'm not carrying on with this, is I was genuinely nervous about being typecast as, oh, he's a funny writer. And if you are a funny writer, because people don't realize, A, how much work goes into writing humor, nor B, how incredibly serious and deep you can get writing humor, people will think I'm a trivial writer. When Terry offered to collaborate, it was like I'd been given this magic free pass, because even though we were writing a funny novel together, people could and did vaguely assume that I'd been there doing the workmanlike real work on the plot, while Terry had been dancing behind me like a maddened fawn, sprinkling bon mots like flowers in my wake. And the truth was, we both got to write, we both wrote everything in that book.
Yes, which is interesting, again, having adapted it, because at first I assumed that you were doing, the plotting and the character work and the love interest, and Terry was sprinkling the gags, exactly as you say. And in fact, what I've learned since adapting some of it, is that some of the scenes I consider to be the funniest are actually your scenes. So this thing is a very, it's a real, it's greater than the sum of its parts, perhaps, although a heck of a pair of sums.
Mark, yeah, I mean, the truth is that Terry and I are very similar writers. I tend to go darker than him, but he absolutely has the engines to go dark. Interestingly, after Good Omens, we talked about doing another book together that wasn't the Good Omens book, but we'd come up with this idea that we really liked of a serial killer who killed serial killers. And this was 1988 to this point, and nobody had done that. We thought we could collaborate on something, and it will be this novel about a serial killer who kills serial killers. But by the end of 89, when we could have done it, Sandman was now this giant engine that was rolling. Discworld had become this giant engine that was rolling. We loved having done Good Omens, but we knew that the possibility of either of us finding the time to write, we wrote Good Omens. The first draft of Good Omens took us 9 weeks.
Wow.
And it was 9 weeks of absolute madness, because we were working on other things at the same time.
Amazing.
But we did it.
One thing about Good Omens I'm curious to know is, did you know where it was going to end up when you were writing it? I know you plan ahead, but...
Ish. We always knew it was going to sort out.
Because that's the thing, because you're dealing with such huge themes. I mean, themes that still, our world's cultural affairs, events are still riven with this stuff as we speak. And yet you're taking this, and without disrespecting it in the least or trivializing it, you take the narrative thread to a conclusion that is very hard to predict at certain points in the book, and it's a wonderful and very uplifting ending.
I think it was written in a very strange way, because we felt an ending rather than planned it. It was written while we were sending one disc backwards and forwards between us to try and stop versions breeding of Good Omens. Mostly what was happening was Terry would take big ongoing plotty stuff. He would tend to take the stuff with the them. And I would tend to do all of the fun stuff around the edges. So I would do all of the, you know, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse stuff or whatever, stuff that didn't rely on knowing what Terry had written that night. But then as it went on, by the end, we were getting to the point where we were going, well, hang on, I haven't written, you know, I haven't written the them, except I've gone and added a few paragraphs and stuff, but I want the them now. So
which is
the kids, Adam and his friends. So from the point where they start cycling off to the airbase and run into Mr. Tyler, chairman of the local residents association, they're mine.
Right.
For example. Whereas the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, who've been mine through all of the book up until the airbase, I handed over to Terry. So he got to write them from the point where they arrive at the airbase onwards. There was an awful lot of just making sure that by the end of it, we'd all done everything because it was so much fun. And people guessed wrong, which fascinated me. People would go, oh, well, I can see, obviously, you've got Terry Pratchett's death. So Terry must have written all the death bits. And I began, well, actually, no, it's Terry's death, kind of, because I loved Terry's death. And I've already written my death. So when we, you know, a skeletal death who speaks in all caps, that's going to be fun. I will do that one because I've never have. So pretty much all of the death stuff is me. The weird thing about Good Omens is it was published 21 years ago, something like that. 25 years ago.
Yeah. I was still at infant school at the time.
It was published 25 years. I was a really smart 4-year-old writer. and it's never been adapted. It's never been adapted into anything, despite showing up on the BBC list of the 100 most best beloved books, despite having gone through edition after edition, despite the fact that, you know, everybody of a certain generation seems to have read it and then they pass it on to everybody of the next generation. But there's never been an actor playing Crowley before. No. There's never been an actor playing Aziraphale before. So watching
Peter and Mark.
Watching Peter and Mark becoming these characters, yes, and yes, going, oh, you may be these forever now. You've actually, it's the equivalent of being the first Jeeves and Wooster or something. You're inhabiting this yes, thing. Yeah. It's been so fascinating watching and listening, I guess, at the table read to all of these things that for so long have just been private for me, suddenly feeling like they're public. They belong to everybody.
And that's quite a funny thing, is Rob, Terry's amanuensis and writing partner and all-round good guy, said to me after the first couple of episodes, all these people around this table. And I said, but that's what you create in a book. You create a world full of people, and when you actually put them all in one room, there's this energy that comes together, and it's a wonderful thing.
It's magical. And I mean, it's fun for me as well, because normally the last few table reads I've been at were for Doctor Who's. And, you know, we had a quarter of the number of characters around the table. So suddenly, you know, people are hanging from the ceilings and, you know, they're sitting three deep and swapping out places at the table in order to read or not read.
It's great while the oxygen lasts.
It really is. Josie Lawrence, a note here for Josie Lawrence, where, you know, we were talking at the beginning about Agnes Nutter, who... The subtitle of the book, even the title of the book, is a collaboration. We couldn't think what it was called. In first draft, it was called William the Antichrist. By the second draft, it was so far from the William books that we knew it had to be called something else. And I called Terry and said, what about Good Omens? And Terry said, I like that. He said, but we should have a subtitle. How about The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter Witch? So the book became Good Omens, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter Witch. And Agnes, and which is one reason why you occasionally find it in, you know, the fortune-telling section of the bookshop. But I love what Josie's done with Agnes Nutter, who could be a small part, but is so incredibly important. And she pervades it with this beautiful, just wonderful voice.
Yeah, magic. It's all magic.
It really is.
It's good magic.
Despite the fact that the most of the book is set in August, it's going to be, I think, really wonderful Christmassy thing.
Remarkably Christmas. It should be anti-Christmas, but it's actually very Christmas.
It's very, very Christmas.